Hi, my name is Misty and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NAVA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story.
This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Books of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too, and I must have this thing. So tonight I get to introduce my brother from another mother, all the way from East Atlanta. It is Patrick D.
Perfect. It's true. Hey, y'all, I'm Patrick. I'm an alcoholic. I don't often speak into a microphone. Can everybody hear me all right? Okay, good. It's a really, I'm really genuinely grateful to be here. There was a long time, for a long time, I was not invited places. And when Lisa invited me here, and every time somebody invites me to go do things, I'm genuinely touched because of that long stretch of really people really not wanting to have very much to do with me. And I revel in being invited to do things. My sobriety is June 18th, 2017. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I sponsor other men in this program. I just want to say one more thing about Alcoholics Anonymous generally before I start my story. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it is one of the most powerful forces I've ever interacted with. There's so much here for so many different kinds of people. Every single kind of person is getting sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so, while Alcoholics Anonymous does not have a monopoly on sobriety, there are other ways to get sober. And if you think you can get sober those ways, Alcoholics Anonymous will not tell you to stop. But if you want to try to stay sober here in AA, know that Alcoholics Anonymous loves you and wants you here and welcomes you here and wants you to keep coming back. And you know, there's not just one white chip. I did not just pick up one white chip. There was 6 years between my first white chip and my most recent one. What I'm about to do, because I know we have some new people, and then I'll start. I'm just going to tell you my story about how I stopped drinking and continued to stop drinking one day at a time. And then we'll end at 8:50. And that's in a nutshell what's going to happen. He's really robotic. I grew up in a small town in South Carolina, and I grew up in the kind of a small town where everybody just knew everybody. And everybody was relatively middle class or poor. And I mention that because I had plenty of family members that were in AA, and all my friends' dads were in AA. And I really grew up thinking that when you grew up, you went to AA, and that's just kind of what happened to you. And that was firmly cemented into by my mother telling me my entire life that I was born an alcoholic. Her husband, my father, was an alcoholic. All of my family are alcoholics and drug addicts. And she made a decision very early on that she was going to tell me that I had that I was allergic to alcohol, and that if I were to drink it, I would grow up to be an alcoholic. And when I did do that, I would need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so when I grew up going to camp, and they asked you what you're allergic to, I would write down alcohol. And it's a true story. It was ingrained early on. And so I grew up in what's commonly referred to as an alcoholic and dysfunctional family. And when time came, about 13 or so, that's when I started drinking alcohol. And it was not the kind of experience that sometimes people mention where it was a serious clarifying force, where things suddenly began to make sense. The truth is that I grew up in a household where I firmly was able to recognize that my parents were very sad. My mother was not getting her needs met, and she was working all the time. And my father was in active addiction, and he was working all the time. And as a child growing up in that, it's hard not to look at that and tell that the adults around are just not having a good time. And so my childhood, which had wonderful moments, some of them very long in duration, was, on the whole, melancholy. And when I drank, that just augmented that melancholy. And I pretty quickly became someone who drank to cover up the sadness, to cover up the fact that I really did not like really who I was, how I spent my time, who I spent my time with, what I was up to. You know, by the time I was 15, I was working 30 hours a week at the restaurant, trying to help pay bills and stuff. I didn't really like that either, so I drank to cover that up. And on the weekends, we'd ingest other sorts of stuff, and that was expensive, so I had to pay for that. And so it was just kind of like that for a while, and it wasn't a good time. And then I got to college, and it was just really more of the same. And my drinking went on, and it did not seem like it was that big of a deal until suddenly material things started happening. Like, I woke up on the side of the road an hour and a half from my home, not knowing how I got there, with a totaled car twice. Stuff like that. And I really began to feel the material, physical impacts of living a life of total unmanageability. I began to steal, eat at soup kitchens. I was deeply unreliable. I was promiscuous. I lied a whole lot. And that self-hatred and shame and that melancholy just became this force of my personality. And I poured alcohol on top of all of it. And it was not too long after that, I just became a daily drinker, and remained one until I came in this last time. And for the last 4 years or so of my drinking, it really just went like this. I would, around lunchtime, I'd start drinking or so, and then I would engage in behavior that was demoralizing, that was really regrettable, that was not aligned with what I really wanted for myself. I had the capacity to say, you know, I'd really like to be someone that went places on time and did things with people with smiles, and I was able to do things for myself. I'd like to be able to go to the dentist. I'd like to be able to buy a new shirt. I'd like to do these things, get a better job. And I had these things in my mind, but what would happen is I would drink, and then I'd engage in these behaviors, and then I would wake up and I would say, I'm never going to do that again. I'm never going to wake up there again. I'm never going to not have enough money ever again. I'm never going to do that thing to that woman ever again. All of that never again stuff. And then by lunchtime the same day, I would say, well, it really wasn't that bad. It really wasn't that bad. I think I'm going to just go get a beer. I'm going to just go over here and get a beer. And it was 4 years then. I had a total inability to stop ingesting alcohol. I could not stop putting alcohol down my throat because I liked the effects produced by it. And so, luckily, I knew what AA was, and I went to it. I was not the kind of person who didn't know what AA was, and I'm very grateful to my mother for that. And I did not come in, like I said, on my first white chip. It was about 6 years between my first one and my most recent one. And luckily, at no point in time did AA say, never come back. They said, keep coming back, which I'm grateful for. And so I came in, and it wasn't anything particularly special. Really, honestly, the special thing that happened to me was I didn't take a drink, and I went to my second meeting, which was crucial, because I would not have made it to my third one if I had not, or my fourth one. And so at that point, I began to do kind of what the lucky people in AA, at least I felt lucky, which is I started to stay sober. I went to meetings. I met people, and they gave me their phone numbers. I was interacting with other humans, which I really had not done a lot of. I was mostly the kind of guy that drank at the bar until the sun went down, and then I went drank by myself. And these people would call me, and it felt like friendship. I had not had sustained, meaningful, curious friendships for a long time, where we asked each other's questions. You know, most of my relationships were based around, you know, sizing up a person and saying, all right, I can probably get this from them in about 2 months. I can get this from them in about 8 months. In about 2 years, I'll be able to get this from them. And that was everybody, as far as I was concerned. You know, because I just had to stay safe. That's how I stayed safe. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had these friends that we'd go to meetings and then go to the diner afterwards. And everybody was really patient with me. Well, in the first year and a half of going to Alcoholics Anonymous, while I pretended to do the steps and taking my time and really peacocking and talking a lot and sharing a lot about how this thing works, and no one ever shut me down. If they did, I was not paying attention. And as far as I'm concerned, Alcoholics Anonymous was really kind to me. They really treated me really well with a lot of tolerance and patience, which I'm immensely grateful for. And I got a sponsor, and I did the steps, which can be found. We have this little blue, for people that might not know, we have a little blue book, and on one of the pages it just gives 12 suggestions. And a lot of people read that book with somebody that they refer to as their sponsor. And there's, in my experience, that worked for me. It was, I wanted to stay sober because if I wasn't, I was going to die. And so I did that thing. It was a suggestion, and it worked for me. So I suggest it to anybody. And my experience with the steps was essentially can be boiled down to the word achievement. I did not have big spiritual breakthroughs where I became a brand new person and felt completely absolved of all the things I had ever done, and I was white as snow, and you know, I just I went to jail for all my crimes, and no one hated me anymore. That's not my experience. My experience was that I did the steps, and every time I did a step, my sponsor that I was working with at the time made me feel good about the fact that I was participating fully in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had a sense of achievement, which was really important to me because I did not feel like at that time I had achieved very much at all. And I really needed a place to feel good. And that was one arena where I was able to feel some sense of accomplishment. The way that I do the steps is I've done them a few different times. Well, I guess I'll stick with the narrative. I apologize. So I continued to do the steps. And then after I did the steps the first time, I got another sponsor and I did them again. And I continued to work on amends, on living amends, and then also on long-term amends that I was unsure of what to do. And some of the most fun things I got to do in my first, you know, 2 to 5 years of sobriety was I took my first ever, like, men's trip. You know, 6 guys, we got on a plane and went to Detroit and just hung out for 4 days and went to meetings. And there, that's not – all my friends up until getting sober were women. I just – was a deeply insecure person who used people, so of course I had no male friends and no real friendships. And I was able to do things like take trips with these guys. And it's a wonderful thing. One of us, me and another guy, even started a meeting that continues to this day that a lot of people care about. And that's another point of achievement and pride for me. The next part after the 5th year was I had a I had another sort of a bottom. People would talk about emotional sobriety, and I had really hit a ceiling. I really thought that being an adult man, a sober person in AA, meant that I show up to meetings and I talk smack and I'm really critical, and I make fun of people, and I'm it's important that I'm funny. And then when people talk about stuff, I call them suggestions, but I'm really just telling them what I think they should do, you know. And I take on that kind of a persona, and in my mind I think, well, isn't this what being sober is? This is what long-term sobriety is, isn't it? Where we all just do that. And unfortunately, what happened to me was, you know, I just started wanting to kill myself. Because that sucked. I just stopped having fun doing that kind of stuff. It was not working for me. I know there's guys with long-term sobriety that like to do that kind of stuff. I think it's great. I hope they keep doing it. But it wore me out. It was a good way of for me to isolate myself and to other myself and to think, well, you know, these people do AA the way that it's supposed to go, and these people don't. And so that means that I get to associate myself with these people, and with these people over here, I just get to hold judgment over them. And that's what emotional sobriety is. And so I had a sort of a bottom there, and I entered into a different 12-step program called Adult Children of Alcoholics and Dysfunctional Families. I mentioned that briefly, where I got to learn about shame and grief, which are not mentioned. Grief is mentioned once in the big book, and shame's not mentioned at all. But for me, as someone who grew up in dysfunction and serious melancholy, shame was a daily activity. It was a daily lens. And I would not be anywhere near thinking about these words or what they mean or how they apply to me and the way I treat other people if I had not gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. It just would not have happened. And I had a similar experience in that program and continue to have similar experiences of just, frankly, joy. So I guess, like, what it's like now... and I apologize if I spoke so quickly, but honestly, this is what my life looks like. I work a lot, and I love what I do, and I get to share it with all sorts of people. Because I own my business, I get to, if people can't afford to do what I, to pay for what I do, I don't have to charge them if I don't want to. I start meetings. A buddy of mine, we started another meeting, and it's a 7 a.m. meeting, and it's 3 days a week, and we're having a good time, and we're going through all the literature that people might not know about in Alcoholics Anonymous. So my emotional sobriety, the next frontier, inmate to inmate, as Bill sees it. There's a lot of really good books out there, and we're just going through them one story at a time. I do service in Alcoholics Anonymous and then outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a wonderful sponsor that I love that I currently work with, and we spend Thursdays together working in prisons. I guess, I'm really ending it early, but that's really the story. I just want to say this. The reason that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was because I drank every single day and had no idea how I was going to stop doing that. But I did know that if I continued to do it, I was going to die. And I was tired of the effects produced by alcohol. I was tired of it, how it made me physically feel, and I was tired because every single day I thought about killing myself in no uncertain terms, just like that. And because of my participation in Alcoholics Anonymous and doing the steps, cultivating a relationship with a higher power, periodically, sometimes frequently, doing inventories of various kinds, and all sorts of other tools and suggestions of the program, I no longer suffer from the physical effects produced by alcohol, including craving it. And then I don't ever think about killing myself. I've completely replaced that rhetoric in my mind. And in fact, just because it makes me uncomfortable, what I do now and what I tell everybody, and I'll tell you the same thing, every single person in here is a precious, unique, valuable, irreplaceable child of God. And I love you. I do. Just the way you are. And these are the ways that I speak to myself now, instead of someone who wishes he wasn't here. So I would firmly suggest Alcoholics Anonymous to anybody who's interested in not drinking one day at a time. And that's pretty shy at a time, but that's the story. Thanks, guys.
Patrick, thank you. You know, they say a good speaker finishes on time, a great speaker finishes early. And if it's okay with you, there might be some questions. I'm not saying there are going to be any. Don't feel any pressure out there. But if you have a question for Patrick about his program, please feel free to raise your hand. And hi, Lisa.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Lisa. I got interested in working in institutions and in for incarcerated communities and prisons and jails. One, because I knew it was a thing. A lot of people might not know that you can do that, but you can. And two, because it's a community that just does not have access to the things that we have access to, the life changing force that comes with this program. All the things that get brought into prison are just that, they're brought in there. There's not a clubhouse in the prison where they get to go to like we do on 8 p.m. on a Monday night. And there's something about that that I found really compelling. And probably the last reason is because I have a serious need for achievement, because it's my goal to love myself in sobriety. And you know what? It makes me feel really good to work in prisons. Oh, yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Hey, I'm Rachel, and I'm an alcoholic. And I just wanted to know how you approach making amends.
Sure, thanks for that. When I was making my amends, I owed some people money, not some people. I owed plenty of people some money. And I called them and said, I owe you $3,500. Can I make a payment plan? I owe you $600. Can I make a payment plan? You know, I owe you $200. Can I pay it? And I did it. I did that kind of amends one at a time when I was able to. You know, it's not fair for me to call somebody if I owe them a bunch of money and I know I'm not gonna be able to pay it for 4 years. The second one is the second kind of amends, like. I have a living amends towards all women, and I do that by volunteering in places that serve women. Although I just did it now, I don't tell people about it. Yes, sir.
My name is Mark, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Mark.
How do you feel leaving those prisons and doing that service work?
Thanks, Mark. You know how I know it's a genuine relationship that I have with those guys? Is sometimes I leave a little annoyed. No, I feel great. I mean, I feel accomplishment. I feel similar feelings of closure. Like a wound is getting tied up, that kind of closure. And then I feel the kind of tired that I want to feel at the end of the day. Like I've earned something. Which is probably adjacent to accomplishment. Thanks for asking. That's good. Yes, sir.
Hey, Indigo. Do you have any recommendations outside of calling your sponsor, doing 12 steps, reading a big book to fill a void that you may have that alcohol used to fill?
Sure. Is that specifically related to you? Do you mind if I ask you that? Is that void? Is it a particular feeling?
I don't know what it is.
Well, what I do now is I identify my feelings, which took a lot of practice. And then after I identify the feeling, I think about what the need might be. And for me, frequently the need is connection. And a lot of the times I'm in a place where I can't get connected. I can't get on the phone. I don't have my big book. My sponsor's at work. He can't just stop what he's doing and make me feel better. And I do this. This is what I do in moments just like that. And this is a true story. This is the first time I did something like this. I was in a place, there was about 70 people, and it was at work. And it was one of those things where I was about to get pointed at and said, you do this in front of these 70 people. And I don't really like these people, to be honest. I don't know these people. None of these people are my AA people. I don't feel comfortable around these people. And I'm prone already to feel deep discomfort. Already. So I kind of walk around with some irritability and discontent and some sadness. And I realized that what I was feeling was serious fear. I was feeling serious fear and isolation, and I felt really unique, like nobody understood who I was. And what I needed was connection. But how was I going to get connection met in that moment? And what I did was I just began to populate the room with the people that I know love me. I thought, well, there's my sponsor right there. And then there's my friend Jesse. And, you know, there's my mother. And then, you know, I even saw an image of you. And soon the room was filled with these people that I know want the absolute best for me. And there were more of my people in that room than there were those people. And I was connected. So that might be one strategy. That's a good question. I feel like that all the time. Yes, sir.
Thanks for the story. Growing up, did you have a belief in God, or did your family go to church at all, or what was your understanding of God?
Yeah, thanks for that. I'm culturally Christian. I was reared Presbyterian. My grandfather was a minister. I believed in a particular kind of God that was, I want to make sure I answer your question. The answer is yes. I was raised in a version of Christianity, and largely the values were based around work with teetotalers, that kind of stuff, just kind of regular Calvinism, poor people's Calvinism kind of stuff. Yes, sir.
My name's Damon.
Hey, Damon.
Outside of the direct link issues of alcohol, you mentioned that you run a business. Having done the 12 steps, have you found or did you consciously try to apply those steps to help navigate some of the human problems we experience in life and some of the complications and just that aren't, directly to alcohol, but just things we're all going to encounter in our day-to-day lives?
Oh, yeah. Thanks for that, Damon. I'm fortunate enough to where my job is pretty isolated. I even called someone today because I had to deal with another person, and I forgot how to do it. I really did. I was getting real angry because I love the effects produced by anger. And I couldn't turn it off. And I thought, man, this is one of my favorite rides. Why would I get off of it? And then I forgot that I was dealing with another child of God who is valuable, irreplaceable, crucial to his operation. And if I forget that, I'll begin to treat that person like they're just something to capitalize on, somebody to take from, somebody in my way, which is how I used to think. I used to think, there's this person, I noticed this about him, I bet I could get access to that in about 3 weeks if I needed to. I bet I could get his mom's car if I needed to. Use that kind of thinking. I don't know if that answers your question, but I struggle with it. I don't yell at people. I don't do that anymore. That'd be a good start if anybody does that.
Hi, Ellen.
Hey, Ellen.
Hey, Ellen. Thank you so much for your story. And thank you for what you just said, because, it's so crazy because a lot of times we'll be thinking about something or we're going through something and we come into a meeting and we always kind of hear that one thing that kind of gets your attention. What you just said was so incredibly beautiful to me, which was, I need to learn that when I'm dealing with just people that are not like, that I need to look at them as a child of God. And to me, if I'm looking at them that way, then I don't feel like there's judgment. I don't feel I don't want them to feel what I always feel is when I walk in a room, okay, am I good enough? You know, is my hair straight? You know, you know, kind of thing.
Yes.
And when you approach them with just exactly what you said, it hit me, like, approach them as a child of God, and then you treat them the way they're supposed to be treated, which is always the whole world to be that way, honestly. And I honestly feel like that if most people in this world led a 12-step program and thought just exactly what you just said, it would be a totally different world. And I appreciate you bringing that up, because I just looked at Lisa and I was like,
whoa,
that really just hit me. Look at everyone as a child of God, because that is exactly what they are. And I come from a thousand forms of fear, you know, and I wouldn't ever want to make anyone else feel what I feel when I walk in the room. Thank you for that.
Oh, sure. Thank you.
That was okay.
Okay.
I'm
Terry.
I'm blessed.
Hey, Terry.
How do you deal with fear of rejection?
Fear of rejection?
Yes.
Well, I don't mind if it's by people I don't. you know, it's different. I mean, if you reject me, that's one thing. I'd be upset about it, but if you're my, you know, my wife or something, or my sister or my best friend, that would hurt me a little more. The thing is that fear, right, it's a fear, is a feeling. It's not a metaphor. It's not an opinion. It's not a concept. It's a feeling, and it lives somewhere inside of me. A lot of my fear lives in my heart rate. And it just means that there's an unmet need. For a long time, I used shame as a mechanism to combat fear, and I don't have to do that anymore. And so if I have a fear of being rejected, I might play the tape out and say, well, what if they reject me? But often, if I'm afraid of being rejected, I remind myself, and I'll do it out loud. I'll say, you know, Patrick, you're a really competent person. You're a competent person. You've been here for X amount of years, and you really have the ability to do a lot of cool stuff. You know, you went to Publix before you came here. You can tie your shoes. And I just start making a list of things that I'm capable of doing. And it sounds funny, and it might even make some people feel a little embarrassed. But I got to tell you, it works for me. So that's how I do it, at the risk of being a little silly. Yes, ma'am. Hey, Alex.
I relate a lot to how you describe yourself, and daily I'm trying to have a nice time despite the facts and information, and I have a walking ball great. You meditate?
No, I don't meditate. Well, the thing is I, you know, what do I do with the rage stuff? Well, you know, rage, I love the effects produced by rage. I love it. I like the way it makes my heart feel. I like the way it makes my hands shake. I like the images it puts in my mind. I like the way it makes my feet tingle. You know, I love the effects produced by rage. You know what? I love the effects produced by self-pity. And I love the effects produced by sadness. I love the effects produced by joy. And the thing, I mean, I'm just a total junkie. I mean, that's just what it is. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I'm a real deal alcoholic. And I just speak to myself, just like I just did to you, out loud. And I do it just like that. And I say, you know what, Patrick, you love the effects produced by rage. That's what's going on right now. You're getting juiced. You are not in contact with reality. And I'm not. You know, because the truth is, and I'm sorry to belabor this, but every single person in here is a valuable child of God. And my rage is not a data point. Now, and then I do that every time it happens, and it's hard at first, and then it gets better. And when I do it successfully, I tell myself, good job. Good job, because I'm taking care of myself, which is an accomplishment, because God's kids need to be taken care of, and I'm good at it. Hey, Clay.
You talked about writing the steps. Did you find a solution to writing the steps?
In writing the steps?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Every time I've done the steps, I've found solutions. And you know what I like to do is I like to do the steps with different people. And I've got a sponsor, but y'all, I'll do the steps with anybody in here. You know what I'm saying? We can go through them right now. my solution in the steps came from doing them as they were outlined in the big book. and then I had an unclenching in my chest at certain points. But there was a lot of moments where, at least the first pass of the steps, I felt accomplishment while doing them. The second pass through the steps, I felt like I was able to treat people a little better. The third pass through the steps is when I worked through some of my anger. And then the fourth pass, which is most recently, I was able to let go of some real deep down stuff that I really hadn't told some people. I'm trying to answer your question, I'm sorry. But I did get solution every single time. Solution number one being I did not drink during any time I ever did a step. And solution number two, at least for me, was I was able to get some emotional relief, some physical relief, because I'm wound up pretty tight. That's a good question. Thank you for that. I swear I didn't know about this question thing. I would not have stopped.
Patrick, thank you for your transparency.
Strange to me, as I rode from town to town, can't put the bottle down, right now feels like it's killing me, life out here gets so depressing, need something to take the edge, you see. An empty hole inside. It's the Bible, the book, or the gun.